himself, or that he understands that the particularity of each sex is a limitation of potential, a cheating of living fullness in some ways. He can't know these things or fully feel them. It is, again, not a sexual problem. It is more global, experienced as the curse of arbitrariness that the body represents. The child comes upon a world in which he could just as well have been born male or female, even dog, cat, or fish, for all that it seems to matter as regards power and control, capacity to withstand pain, annihilation, and death. The horror of sexual differentiation is a horror of biological fact, as Brown so well says. It is a fall out of illusion into sobering reality. It is a horror of assuming an immense new burden, the burden of the meaning of life and the body, of the fatality of one's incompleteness, his helplessness, his finitude. And this, finally, is the hopeless terror of the castration complex that makes men tremble in their nightmares. It expresses the realization by the child that he is saddled with an impossible project, that the causa sui pursuit on which he is launched cannot be achieved by body sexual means, even by protesting a body different from the mother. The fortress of the body, the primary base for narcissistic operations against the world in order to ensure one's boundless powers, crumbles like sand. This is the tragic dethroning of the child, the ejection from paradise that the castration complex represents. Once he used any bodily zone or appendage for his Oedipal project of self-generation, now the very genitals themselves mock his self-sufficiency. This brings up the whole matter of why sexuality is such a universal problem. No one has written about the problem of sexuality better than Rank in his stunning essay on sexual enlightenment. As I am going to talk about it in some detail in Chapter 8, there is no point in repeating that discussion here. But we can anticipate it by showing how sexuality is inseparable from our existential paradox, the dualism of human nature. The person is both a self and a body, and from the beginning there is the confusion about where he really is, in the symbolic inner self or in the physical body. Each phenomenological realm is different. The inner self represents the freedom of thought, imagination, and the infinite reach of symbolism. The body represents determinism and boundedness. The child gradually learns that his freedom as a unique being is dragged back by the body and its appendages, which dictate what he is. For this reason, sexuality is as much a problem for the adult as for the child. The physical solution to the problem of who we are and why we have emerged on this planet is no help. In fact, it is a terrible threat. It doesn't tell the person what he is deep down inside, what kind of distinctive gift he is to work upon the world. This is why it is so difficult to have sex without guilt. Guilt is there because the body casts a shadow on the person's inner freedom, his real self that, through the act of sex, is being forced into a standardized mechanical biological role. Even worse, the inner self is not even being called into consideration at all. The body takes over completely for the total person, and this kind of guilt makes the inner self shrink and threaten to disappear. This is why a woman asks for assurance that the man wants me and not only my body. She is painfully conscious that her own distinctive inner personality can be dispensed with in the sexual act. If it is dispensed with, it doesn't count. The fact is that the man usually does want only the body, and the woman's total personality is reduced to a mere animal role. The existential paradox vanishes, and one has no distinctive humanity to protest. One creative way of coping with this is, of course, to allow it to happen and to go with it. What the psychoanalysts call regression in the service of the ego. The person becomes, for a time, merely his physical self, and so absolves the painfulness of the existential paradox and the guilt that goes with sex. Love is one great key to this kind of sexuality, because it allows the collapse of the individual into the animal dimension without fear and guilt, but instead with trust and assurance that his distinctive inner freedom will not be negated by an animal surrender. The primal scene. This is the right place to discuss another psychoanalytic idea that always seems to many to bypass credulity, the so-called trauma of the primal scene. The orthodox psychoanalytic notion was that when the child witnessed sexual intercourse between the parents, the primal scene, it left him with a deep-seated trauma because he could not take part in it. Freud talked about the actual stimulation of sexual excitement upon observation of parental coitus. Put so bluntly, the idea seems incredible enough. But we must remember that Freud prided himself, above all, on the discovery of infantile sexuality. In the minds of other psychoanalysts, the idea is given a slightly different emphasis. Thus, as Roheim put it, the primal scene represents the child's wish for reunion with the mother fulfilled. But he sees his father in his place, and instead of a complete identification with the succoring mother, he sees the violent motion of a struggle. Finally, Ferenczi, who was a keen student of the effects of the parents on the child, gives the matter another slightly different twist from Freud's stark formulation. If intimate parental intercourse is observed by the child in the first or second year of life, when its capacity for excitement is already there, but it lacks as yet adequate outlets for its emotion, an infantile neurosis may result. Roheim and Ferenczi, then, are actually talking about quite different things from Freud's subject. Roheim is talking about identification with the mother, who represents the total support of the child, and the child's inability to understand the relation of his loved object with other objects like the father. Ferenczi is saying that the child is overwhelmed by emotions that he cannot yet organize. This is precisely where a more existential interpretation of the problem comes in. The child uses his body as a causa sui project. He only definitely abandons this project when he learns the impossibility of it. Each of these alternatives is a life-and-death matter for him, and so, if we are going to talk about trauma, it must be because of a confusion of life-and-death matters. Even when we are grown, most of us experience some distaste and disillusionment at the idea of our parents having intercourse. It doesn't seem the right thing for them to do. I think the exact reason for our distaste is that their image is confounded in our eyes. The thing that the parents represent most of all is the discouragement of the body as a causa sui project. They represent the castration complex, disillusionment with the body, and the fear of it. Even more, they themselves are the living embodiment of the cultural worldview that the child has to internalize in order for him to get out of his impasse with his body. When they themselves do not transcend the body in their most intimate relations, the child must experience some anxious confusion. How is his struggling ego to handle these double messages and make sense out of them? Furthermore, one of these messages is given in concrete physical grunts, groans, and movement that must be overwhelming, especially as it is precisely the horror of the body that the child is trying to overcome. If he tries to fall back on the body role and imitate his parents, they become anxious or furious. He can well feel betrayed by them. They reserve their bodies for the closest relationship, but deny it to him. They discourage physicalness with all the powers at their command, and yet they themselves practice it with an all-absorbing vengeance. When we take all this together, we can see that the primal scene can truly be a trauma, not because the child can't get into the sexual act and express his own impulses, but rather because the primal scene is itself a complex symbol combining the horror of the body, the betrayal of the cultural superego, and the absolute blockage of any action that the child can take in the situation, or any straightforward understanding that he can have of it. It is the symbol of an anxious multiple bind. The body, then, is one's animal fate that has to be struggled against in some ways. At the same time, it offers experiences and sensations, concrete pleasure that the inner symbolic world lacks. No wonder man is impaled on the horns of sexual problems, why Freud saw that sex was so prominent in human life, especially in the neurotic conflicts of his patients. Sex is an inevitable component of man's confusion over the meaning of his life, a meaning split hopelessly into two realms, symbols, freedom, and body, fate. No wonder, too, that most of us never abandon entirely the early attempts of the child to use the body and its appendages as a fortress or a machine to magically coerce the world. We try to get metaphysical answers out of the body that the body, as a material thing, cannot possibly give. We try to answer the transcendent mystery of creation by experiences in one, partial, physical product of that creation. This is why the mystique of sex is so widely practiced, say, in traditional France, and at the same time is so disillusioning. It is comfortingly infantile in its indulgence and its pleasure, yet so self-defeating of real awareness and growth if the person is using it to try to answer metaphysical questions. It then becomes a lie about reality, a screen against full consciousness. If the adult reduces the problem of life to the area of sexuality, he repeats the fetishization of the child who focuses the problem of the mother upon her genitals. Sex, then, becomes a screen for terror, a fetishization of full consciousness about the real problem of life. But this discussion doesn't exhaust the reasons that sex is so prominent a part of the confusions of life. Sex is also a positive way of working on one's personal freedom project. After all, it is one of the few areas of real privacy that a person has in an existence that is almost wholly social, entirely shaped by the parents and society. In this sense, sex as a project represents a retreat from the standardizations and monopolizations of the social world. No wonder people dedicate themselves so all-consumingly to it, often from childhood on, in the form of secret masturbations that represent a protest and a triumph of the personal self. As we will see in part two of this book, Rank goes so far as to say that this use of sex explains all sexual conflicts in the individual, from masturbation to the most varied perversions. The person attempts to use his sex in an entirely individual way in order to control it and relieve it of its determinism. It is as though one tried to transcend the body by depriving it entirely of its given character, to make sport and new invention in place of what nature intended. The perversions of children certainly show this very clearly. They are the true artists of the body, using it as clay to assert their symbolic mastery. Freud saw this and recorded it as polymorphous perversity, which is one way of talking about it. But he seems not to have realized that this kind of play is already a very serious attempt to transcend determinism, not merely an animal search for a variety of body's own pleasures. By the time the child grows up, the inverted search for a personal existence through perversity gets set in an individual mold, and it becomes more secret. It has to be secret because the community won't stand for the attempt by people to wholly individualize themselves. If there is going to be a victory over human incompleteness and limitation, it has to be a social project, and not an individual one. Society wants to be the one to decide how people are to transcend death. It will tolerate the causa sui project only if it fits into the standard social project. Otherwise, there is the alarm of anarchy. This is one of the reasons for bigotry and censorship of all kinds over personal morality. People fear that the standard morality will be undermined, another way of saying that they fear they will no longer be able to control life and death. A person is said to be socialized precisely when he accepts to sublimate the body sexual character of his Oedipal project. Now, these euphemisms mean usually that he accepts to work on becoming the father of himself by abandoning his own project and by giving it over to the fathers. The castration complex has done its work, and one submits to social reality. He can now deflate his own desires and claims, and can play it safe in the world of the powerful elders. He can even give his body over to the tribe, the state, the embracing magical umbrella of the elders and their symbols. That way, it will no longer be a dangerous negation for him. But there is no real difference between a childish impossibility and an adult one. The only thing that the person achieves is a practiced self-deceit, what we call the mature character. Chapter 4. Human Character as a Vital Lie. Take stock of those around you, and you will hear them talk in precise terms about themselves and their surroundings, which would seem to point to them having ideas on the matter. But start to analyze those ideas, and you will find that they hardly reflect in any way the reality to which they appear to refer. And if you go deeper, you will discover that there is not even an attempt to adjust the ideas to this reality. Quite the contrary. Through these notions, the individual is trying to cut off any personal vision of reality, of his own very life. For life is, at the start, a chaos in which one is lost. The individual suspects this, but he is frightened at finding himself face to face with this terrible reality, and tries to cover it over with a curtain of fantasy, where everything is clear. It does not worry him that his ideas are not true. He uses them as trenches for the defense of his existence, as scarecrows to frighten away reality. José Ortega y Gasset. The problem of anality and the castration complex already takes us a long way toward answering the question that intrigues us all. If the basic quality of heroism is genuine courage, why are so few people truly courageous? Why is it so rare to see a man who can stand on his own feet? Even the great Carlyle, who frightened many people, proclaimed that he stood on his father as on a stone pillar buried in the ground under him. The unspoken implication is that if he stood on his own feet alone, the ground would cave in under him. This question goes right to the heart of the human condition, and we shall be attacking it from many sides all through this book. I once wrote that I thought the reason man was so naturally cowardly was that he felt he had no authority, and the reason he had no authority was in the very nature of the way the human animal is shaped. All our meanings are built into us from the outside, from our dealings with others. This is what gives us a self and a superego. Our whole world of right and wrong, good and bad, our name, precisely who we are, is grafted into us, and we never feel we have authority to offer things on our own. How could we, I argued, since we feel ourselves in many ways guilty and beholden to others, a lesser creation of theirs, indebted to them for our very birth? But this is only part of the story, the most superficial and obvious part. There are deeper reasons for our lack of courage, and if we are going to understand man, we have to dig for them. The psychologist Abraham Maslow had the keenest sense for significant ideas, and shortly before his recent untimely death, he began to attack the problem of the fear of standing alone. Maslow used a broad humanistic perspective in his work, and he liked to talk about concepts like actualizing one's potential and one's full humanness. He saw these as natural developmental urges and wondered what holds them up, what blocks them. He answered the question in existential language, using terms like the fear of one's own greatness and the evasion of one's destiny. This approach throws a new light on the problem of courage. In his words, "We fear our highest possibility, as well as our lowest ones. We are generally afraid to become that which we can glimpse in our most perfect moments. We enjoy and even thrill to the godlike possibilities we see in ourselves in such peak moments. And yet we simultaneously shiver with weakness, awe, and fear before these very same possibilities." Maslow used an apt term for this evasion of growth, this fear of realizing one's own fullest powers. He called it the Jonah syndrome. He understood the syndrome as the evasion of the full intensity of life. "We are just not strong enough to endure more. It is just too shaking and wearing. So often people in ecstatic moments say, 'It's too much,' or 'I can't stand it,' or 'I could die.' Delirious happiness cannot be borne for long. Our organisms are just too weak for any large doses of greatness." The Jonah syndrome, then, seen from this basic point of view, is partly a justified fear of being torn apart, of losing control, of being shattered and disintegrated, even of being killed by the experience. And the result of this syndrome is what we would expect a weak organism to do, to cut back the full intensity of life. For some people, this evasion of one's own growth, setting low levels of aspiration, the fear of doing what one is capable of doing, voluntary self-crippling, pseudo-stupidity, mock humility, are in fact defenses against grandiosity. Note: as we shall see in the pages that follow, other thinkers had their version of the Jonah syndrome long before Maslow. I am thinking especially of Rank, who gave the idea no special name, and of Freud, who probably began our scientific approach to it with his famous discovery of the wrecked by success syndrome. He saw that certain people couldn't stand success after they had achieved it. As it was too much for them, they quickly gave it up or went to pieces. I am leaving Freud out here because Maslow so well represents the existential approach that I believe is a considerable expansion of the Freudian horizon, even though Freud himself developed far toward an existential framework, as we shall see in Chapter 6, where we discuss this problem again. End of note. It all boils down to a simple lack of strength to bear the superlative, to open oneself to the totality of experience, an idea that was well appreciated by William James and more recently was developed in phenomenological terms in the classic work of Rudolf Otto. Otto talked about the terror of the world, the feeling of overwhelming awe, wonder, and fear in the face of creation, the miracle of it, the mysterium tremendum et fascinosum of each single thing, of the fact that there are things at all. What Otto did was to get descriptively at man's natural feeling of inferiority in the face of the massive transcendence of creation, his real creature feeling before the crushing and negating miracle of being. We now understand how a phenomenology of religious experience ties into psychology, right at the point of the problem of courage. We might say that the child is a natural coward. He cannot have the strength to support the terror of creation. The world as it is, creation out of the void, things as they are, things as they are not, are too much for us to be able to stand. Or better, they would be too much for us to bear without crumbling in a faint, trembling like a leaf, standing in a trance in response to the movement, colors, and odors of the world. I say would be because most of us, by the time we leave childhood, have repressed our vision of the primary miraculousness of creation. We have closed it off, changed it, and no longer perceive the world as it is to raw experience. Sometimes we may recapture this world by remembering some striking childhood perceptions, how suffused they were in emotion and wonder, how a favorite grandfather looked, or one's first love in his early teens. We change these heavily emotional perceptions precisely because we need to move about in the world with some kind of equanimity, some kind of strength and directness. We can't keep gaping with our heart in our mouth, greedily sucking up with our eyes everything great and powerful that strikes us. The great boon of repression is that it makes it possible to live decisively in an overwhelmingly miraculous and incomprehensible world, a world so full of beauty, majesty, and terror that if animals perceived it at all, they would be paralyzed to act. But nature has protected the lower animal by endowing them with instincts. An instinct is a programmed perception that calls into play a programmed reaction. It is very simple. Animals are not moved by what they cannot react to. They live in a tiny world, a sliver of reality, one neurochemical program that keeps them walking behind their nose and shuts out everything else. But look at man, the impossible creature. Here, nature seems to have thrown caution to the winds along with the programmed instincts. She created an animal who has no defense against full perception of the external world, an animal completely open to experience, not only in front of his nose, in his Umwelt, but in many other Umwelten. He can relate not only to animals in his own species, but in some ways to all other species. He can contemplate not only what is edible for him, but everything that grows. He not only lives in this moment, but expands his inner self to yesterday, his curiosity to centuries ago, his fears to 5 billion years from now when the sun will cool, his hopes to an eternity from now. He lives not only on a tiny territory, nor even on an entire planet, but in a galaxy, in a universe, and in dimensions beyond visible universes. It is appalling the burden that man bears, the experiential burden. As we saw in the last chapter, man can't even take his own body for granted as can other animals. It is not just hind feet, a tail that he drags, that are just there, limbs to be used and taken for granted or chewed off when caught in a trap, and when they give pain and prevent movement. Man's body is a problem to him that has to be explained. Not only his body is strange, but also its inner landscape, the memories and dreams. Man's very insides, his self, are foreign to him. He doesn't know who he is, why he was born, what he is doing on the planet, what he is supposed to do, what he can expect. His own existence is incomprehensible to him, a miracle just like the rest of creation, closer to him, right near his pounding heart, but for that reason all the more strange. Each thing is a problem, and man can shut out nothing. As Maslow has well said, it is precisely the godlike in ourselves that we are ambivalent about, fascinated by and fearful of, motivated to and defensive against. This is one aspect of the human predicament, that we are simultaneously worms and gods. There it is again, gods with anuses. The historic value of Freud's work is that it came to grips with the peculiar animal that man was. The animal that was not programmed by instincts to close off perception and assure automatic equanimity and forceful action. Man had to invent and create out of himself the limitations of perception and the equanimity to live on this planet. And so the core of psychodynamics, the formation of the human character, is a study in human self-limitation and in the terrifying costs of that limitation. The hostility to psychoanalysis in the past, today, and in the future will always be a hostility against admitting that man lives by lying to himself and about his world, and that character, to follow Ferenczi and Brown, is a vital lie. I particularly like the way Maslow has summed up this contribution of Freudian thought. Freud's greatest discovery, the one which lies at the root of psychodynamics, is that the great cause of much psychological illness is the fear of knowledge of oneself, of one's emotions, impulses, memories, capacities, potentialities of one's destiny. We have discovered that fear of knowledge of oneself is very often isomorphic with and parallel with fear of the outside world. And what is this fear but a fear of the reality of creation in relation to our powers and possibilities? In general, this kind of fear is defensive, in the sense that it is a protection of our self-esteem, of our love and respect for ourselves. We tend to be afraid of any knowledge that could cause us to despise ourselves or to make us feel inferior, weak, worthless, evil, shameful. We protect ourselves and our ideal image of ourselves by repression and similar defenses, which are essentially techniques by which we avoid becoming conscious of unpleasant or dangerous truths. The individual has to repress globally, from the entire spectrum of his experience, if he wants to feel a warm sense of inner value and basic security. This sense of value and support is something that nature gives to each animal by the automatic instinctive programming and in the pulsating of the vital processes. But man, poor denuded creature, has to build and earn inner value and security. He must repress his smallness in the adult world, his failures to live up to adult commands and codes. He must repress his own feelings of physical and moral inadequacy, not only the inadequacy of his good intentions, but also his guilt and his evil intentions. The death wishes and hatreds that result from being frustrated and blocked by the adults. He must repress his parents' inadequacy, their anxieties and terrors, because these make it difficult for him to feel secure and strong. He must repress his own anality, his compromising bodily functions that spell his mortality, his fundamental expendability in nature. And with all this, and more that we leave unsaid, he must repress the primary awesomeness of the external world. In his later years, Freud evidently came to realize, as Adler had earlier, that the thing that really bothers the child is the nature of his world, not so much his own inner drives. He talked less about the power of the Oedipus complex and more about human perplexity and helplessness in the face of nature's dreaded forces, the terrors of nature, the painful riddle of death, our anxiety in the face of life's dangers, and the great necessities of fate against which there is no remedy. And when it came to the central problem of anxiety, he no longer talked, as he had in his early work, about the child's being overwhelmed from within by his instinctual urges. Instead, Freud's formulations became existential. Anxiety was now seen largely as a matter of the reaction to global helplessness, abandonment, fate. I therefore maintain that the fear of death is to be regarded as an analog of the fear of castration, and that the situation to which the ego reacts is a state of being forsaken or deserted by the protecting superego, by the powers of destiny, which puts an end to security against every danger. This formulation indicates a great broadening of perspective. Add to it a generation or two of psychoanalytic clinical work, and we have achieved a remarkably faithful understanding of what really bothers the child, how life is really too much for him, how he has to avoid too much thought, too much perception, too much life. And at the same time, how he has to avoid the death that rumbles behind and underneath every carefree activity, that looks over his shoulder as he plays. The result is that we now know that the human animal is characterized by two great fears that other animals are protected from: the fear of life and the fear of death. In the science of man, it was Otto Rank, above all, who brought these fears into prominence, based his whole system of thought on them, and showed how central they were to an understanding of man. At about the same time that Rank wrote, Heidegger brought these fears to the center of existential philosophy. He argued that the basic anxiety of man is anxiety about being in the world, as well as anxiety of being in the world. That is, both fear of death and fear of life, of experience and individuation. Man is reluctant to move out into the overwhelmingness of his world, the real dangers of it. He shrinks back from losing himself in the all-consuming appetites of others, from spinning out of control in the clutchings and clawings of men, beasts, and machines. As an animal organism, man senses the kind of planet he has been put down on, the nightmarish, demonic frenzy in which nature has unleashed billions of individual, organismic appetites of all kinds. not to mention earthquakes, meteors, and hurricanes, which seem to have their own hellish appetites. Each thing, in order to deliciously expand, is forever gobbling up others. Appetites may be innocent because they are naturally given, but any organism caught in the myriad cross-purposes of this planet is a potential victim of this very innocence, and it shrinks away from life lest it lose its own. Life can suck one up, sap his energies, submerge him, take away his self-control, give so much new experience so quickly that he will burst, make him stick out among others, emerge onto dangerous ground, load him up with new responsibilities which need great strength to bear, expose him to new contingencies, new chances. Above all, there is the danger of a slip-up, an accident, a chance disease, and of course of death, the final sucking up, the total submergence and negation. The great scientific simplification of psychoanalysis is the concept that the whole of early experience is an attempt by the child to deny the anxiety of his emergence, his fear of losing his support, of standing alone, helpless, and afraid. The child's character, his style of life, is his way of using the power of others, the support of the things and the ideas of his culture, to banish from his awareness the actual fact of his natural impotence. Not only his impotence to avoid death, but his impotence to stand alone, firmly rooted on his own powers. In the face of the terror of the world, the miracle of creation, the crushing power of reality, not even the tiger has secure and limitless power, much less the child. His world is a transcendent mystery. Even the parents to whom he relates in a natural and secure dependency are primary miracles. How else could they appear? The mother is the first awesome miracle that haunts the child his whole life, whether he lives within her powerful aura or rebels against it. The superordinancy of his world intrudes upon him in the form of fantastic faces, smiling up close through gaping teeth, rolling eerie eyes, piercing him from afar with burning and threatening glances. He lives in a world of flesh and blood, quackiutal masks that mock his self-sufficiency. The only way he could securely oppose them would be to know that he is as godlike as they, but he can never know this straightforwardly and unambiguously. There is no secure answer to the awesome mystery of the human face that scrutinizes itself in the mirror. No answer, at any rate, that can come from the person himself, from his own center. One's own face may be godlike in its miraculousness, but one lacks the godlike power to know what it means, the godlike strength to have been responsible for its emergence. In these ways, then, we understand that if the child were to give in to the overpowering character of reality and experience, he would not be able to act with the kind of equanimity we need in our non-instinctive world. So one of the first things a child has to do is to learn to abandon ecstasy, to do without awe, to leave fear and trembling behind. Only then can he act with a certain oblivious self-confidence when he has naturalized his world. We say naturalized, but we mean unnaturalized, falsified, with the truth obscured, the despair of the human condition hidden, a despair that the child glimpses in his night terrors and daytime phobias and neuroses. This despair he avoids by building defenses, and these defenses allow him to feel a basic sense of self-worth, of meaningfulness, of power. They allow him to feel that he controls his life and his death, that he really does live and act as a willful and free individual, that he has a unique and self-fashioned identity, that he is somebody, not just a trembling accident, germinated on a hothouse planet that Carlyle for all time called a hall of doom. We called one's lifestyle a vital lie, and now we can understand better why we said it was vital. It is a necessary and basic dishonesty about oneself and one's whole situation. This revelation is what the Freudian revolution in thought really ends up in, and is the basic reason that we still strain against Freud. We don't want to admit that we are fundamentally dishonest about reality, that we do not really control our own lives. We don't want to admit that we do not stand alone, that we always rely on something that transcends us, some system of ideas and powers in which we are embedded and which support us. This power is not always obvious. It need not be overtly a god or openly a stronger person, but it can be the power of an all-absorbing activity, a passion, a dedication to a game, a way of life, that, like a comfortable web, keeps a person buoyed up and ignorant of himself, of the fact that he does not rest on his own center. All of us are driven to be supported in a self-forgetful way, ignorant of what energies we really draw on, of the kind of lie we have fashioned in order to live securely and serenely. Augustine was a master analyst of this, as were Kierkegaard, Scheller, and Tillich in our day. They saw that man could strut and boast all he wanted, but that he really drew his courage to be from a god, a string of sexual conquests, a big brother, a flag, the proletariat, and the fetish of money and the size of a bank balance. The defenses that form a person's character support a grand illusion. And when we grasp this, we can understand the full drivenness of man. He is driven away from himself, from self-knowledge, self-reflection. He is driven toward things that support the lie of his character, his automatic equanimity. But he is also drawn precisely toward those things that make him anxious, as a way of skirting them masterfully, testing himself against them, controlling them by defying them. As Kierkegaard taught us, anxiety lures us on, becomes the spur to much of our energetic activity. We flirt with our own growth, but also dishonestly. This explains much of the friction in our lives. We enter symbiotic relationships in order to get the security we need, in order to get relief from our anxieties, our aloneness and helplessness. But these relationships also bind us. They enslave us even further because they support the lie we have fashioned. So we strain against them in order to be more free. The irony is that we do this straining uncritically, in a struggle within our own armor, as it were, and so we increase our drivenness, the second-hand quality of our struggle for freedom. Even in our flirtations with anxiety, we are unconscious of our motives. We seek stress, we push our own limits, but we do it with our screen against despair and not with despair itself. We do it with the stock market, with sports cars, with atomic missiles, with the success ladder in the corporation or the competition in the university. We do it in the prison of a dialogue with our own little family, by marrying against their wishes or choosing a way of life because they frown on it, and so on. Hence the complicated and second-hand quality of our entire drivenness. Even in our passions, we are nursery children playing with toys that represent the real world. Even when these toys crash and cost us our lives or our sanity, we are cheated of the consolation that we were in the real world instead of the playpen of our fantasies. We still did not meet our doom on our own manly terms, in contest with objective reality. It is fateful and ironic how the lie we need in order to live dooms us to a life that is never really ours. It was not until the working out of modern psychoanalysis that we could understand something the poets and religious geniuses have long known, that the armor of character was so vital to us that to shed it meant to risk death and madness. It is not hard to reason out. If character is a neurotic defense against despair and you shed that defense, you admit the full flood of despair, the full realization of the true human condition, what men are really afraid of, what they struggle against and are driven toward and away from. Freud summed it up beautifully when he somewhere remarked that psychoanalysis cured the neurotic misery in order to introduce the patient to the common misery of life. Neurosis is another word for describing a complicated technique for avoiding misery. But reality is the misery. That is why, from earliest times, sages have insisted to see reality one must die and be reborn. The idea of death and rebirth was present in shamanistic times, in Zen thought, in Stoic thought, in Shakespeare's King Lear, as well as in Judeo-Christian and modern existential thought. But it was not until scientific psychology that we could understand what was at stake in the death and rebirth. That man's character was a neurotic structure that went right to the heart of his humanness. As Frederick Perls put it, to suffer one's death and to be reborn is not easy. And it is not easy precisely because so much of one has to die. I like the way Perls conceived the neurotic structure as a thick edifice built up of four layers. The first two layers are the everyday layers, the tactics that the child learns to get along in society by the facile use of words, to win ready approval and to placate others, and move them along with him. These are the glib, empty talk, cliché, and role-playing layers. Many people live out their lives never getting underneath them. The third layer is a stiff one to penetrate. It is the impasse that covers our feeling of being empty and lost, the very feeling that we try to banish in building up our character defenses. Underneath this layer is the fourth and most baffling one. the death or fear of death layer. And this, as we have seen, is the layer of our true and basic animal anxieties, the terror that we carry around in our secret heart. Only when we explode this fourth layer, says Pearls, do we get to the layer of what we might call our authentic self, what we really are without sham, without disguise, without defenses against fear. From this sketch of the complex rings of defense that compose our character, our neurotic shield that protects our pulsating vitality from the dread of truth, we can get some idea of the difficult and excruciatingly painful all-or-nothing process that psychological rebirth is. And when it is through psychologically, it only begins humanly. The worst is not the death, but the rebirth itself. There's the rub. What does it mean to be born again for man? It means for the first time to be subjected to the terrifying paradox of the human condition, since one must be born not as a god, but as a man, or as a god-worm, or a god who shits. Only this time without the neurotic shield that hides the full ambiguity of one's life. And so we know that every authentic rebirth is a real ejection from paradise, as the lives of Tolstoy, Piggy, and others attest. It takes men of granite, men who are automatically powerful, secure in their drivenness, we might say, and it makes them tremble, makes them cry, as Piggy stood on the platforms of Parisian buses with hot tears rolling down his cheeks while he mumbled prayers. It was Rank who very early admitted that anxiety could not all be overcome therapeutically, and this is what he meant, that it is impossible to stand up to the terror of one's condition without anxiety. It was Andras Angyal who got to the heart of the matter of psychotherapeutic rebirth when he said that the neurotic who has had therapy is like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He can never take his cure for granted, and the best sign of the genuineness of that cure is that he lives with humility. Full humans and part humans. This discussion brings up a basic contradiction of the whole therapeutic enterprise that has not been aired widely enough. We are going to be dwelling on it at the close of this book, but this is the right place to introduce it. It is simply this. What sense does it make to talk about enjoying one's full humanness, as Maslow urges along with so many others, if full humanness means the primary misadjustment to the world? If you get rid of the four-layered neurotic shield, the armor that covers the characterological lie about life, how can you talk about enjoying this Pyrrhic victory? The person gives up something restricting and illusory, it is true, but only to come face to face with something even more awful, genuine despair. Full humanness means full fear and trembling, at least some of the waking day. When you get a person to emerge into life, away from his dependencies, his automatic safety in the cloak of someone else's power, what joy can you promise him with the burden of his aloneness? When you get a person to look at the sun as it bakes down on the daily carnage taking place on Earth, the ridiculous accidents, the utter fragility of life, the powerlessness of those he thought most powerful, what comfort can you give him from a psychotherapeutic point of view? Luis Buñuel likes to introduce a mad dog into his films as counterpoint to the secure daily routine of repressed living. The meaning of his symbolism is that no matter what men pretend, they are only one accidental bite away from utter fallibility. The artist disguises the incongruity that is the pulse beat of madness, but he is aware of it. What would the average man do with a full consciousness of absurdity? He has fashioned his character for the precise purpose of putting it between himself and the facts of life. It is his special tour de force that allows him to ignore incongruities, to nourish himself on impossibilities, to thrive on blindness. He accomplishes thereby a peculiarly human victory, the ability to be smug about terror. Sartre has called man a useless passion because he is so hopelessly bungled, so deluded about his true condition. He wants to be a god with only the equipment of an animal, and so he thrives on fantasies. As Ortega so well put it in the epigraph we have used for this chapter, man uses his ideas for the defense of his existence, to frighten away reality. This is a serious game, the defense of one's existence. How take it away from people and leave them joyous? Maslow talks very convincingly about self-actualization and the ecstasy of peak experiences, wherein a person comes to see the world in all its awe and splendor and senses his own free inner expansion and the miracle of his being. Maslow calls this state being cognition, the openness of perception to the truth of the world, a truth concealed by the neurotic distortions and illusions that protect one against overwhelming experiences. This idea is fine and correct, this enjoinder to develop the capacity for being cognition, in order to break out of the one-dimensionality of our lives, the cave of our imprisoning security. But like most things human, it is a very paradoxical kind of triumph. This was already clearly seen by Maslow, when he talked about the dangers of being cognition. Maslow was too broad-minded and sober to imagine that being cognition did not have an underside. But he didn't go far enough toward pointing out what a dangerous underside it was, that it could undermine one's whole position in the world. It can't be overstressed, one final time, that to see the world as it really is devastating and terrifying. It achieves the very result that the child has painfully built his character over the years in order to avoid. It makes routine, automatic, secure, self-confident activity impossible. It makes thoughtless living in the world of men an impossibility. It places a trembling animal at the mercy of the entire cosmos and the problem of the meaning of it. Let us digress here for a moment in order to show that this view of character is not one put forth by morbid existentialists, but instead represents the now-agreed merger of Freudian and post-Freudian psychology. A subtle but very profound change has come over our understanding of the early development of the child. It is a change that can be summed up briefly in the shifts from Freudian to post-Freudian psychology, and now back again to a sobered Freudianism. Freud saw the child as an antagonist of his world, as someone who had drives of aggression and sexuality that he wanted to work on the world. But as he could not work them out as a child, he had to suffer frustration and develop substitute satisfactions. The thwarting of these drives in childhood led to such a residue of bitterness and antisociality that the world would always be peopled by a type of animal that resented what it had done to him, what it had deprived him of. He would be a mean animal, deep down, one who felt cheated, one who harbored choked-up feelings and desires. He might on the surface be pleasant enough, responsible, creative. But underneath it all was a residue of trashiness that threatened to burst out and that in any event would somehow work itself out on others or on himself. Freud's theory of innate instincts was undermined very early in social psychological quarters and very late within psychoanalysis itself, and a new view of the child came into vogue. It tended to see the child as neutral, instinct-free, basically malleable, apart from some unknown factors of hereditary constitution and temperament. The child was looked upon wholly as a creature shaped by his environment. In this view, the parents were thought to be responsible for the child's repressions, for the character defenses that he developed, and for the kind of person he turned out to be, as they had provided him with an environment and molded him to it. Even more than that, as the parents had opposed the child's natural, energetic, and free expansion, and had demanded his surrender to their world, they could be considered in some fundamental way as guilty for whatever warpings his character had. If the child had no instincts, he at least had plenty of free energy and a natural innocence of the body. He sought continual activity and diversion, wanted to move about his world in its entirety, to bend it to his use and delight as much as possible. He sought to express himself spontaneously, feel the most satisfaction in his bodily processes, derive the most comfort, thrill, and pleasure from others. But as this kind of limitless expansion is not possible in the world, the child has to be checked for his own good, and the parents were the checkers of his activity. Whatever attitudes the child had toward himself, his body, and his world were considered to have been implanted by his experience with his trainers and with his immediate environment. This was the post-Freudian view of character development, the reaction against Freud's instinctivism. Actually, it is pre-Freudian, dating from the Enlightenment and Rousseau and Marx. In recent years, the most biting and carefully thought-out critique of this view was given by Norman O'Brown. The epithets he used against Fromm and the neo-Freudians were bitter indeed for a book that called us all back to Eros. But the gravamen of Brown's critique was a serious one that had been overlooked by many in recent decades. That the situation of the child was an impossible one, that he had to fashion his own defenses against the world, had to find a way of surviving in it. As we saw in Chapter 3, the child's own existential dilemmas gave him his task quite independently of the parents. His attitudes came to him from his need to adapt to the whole desperate human condition, not merely to attune himself to the whims of his parents. The student of ideas is entitled to wonder what kind of book Brown would have fashioned out of his brilliance if he had digested Adler and Rank with the thoroughness with which he studied Freud. It was Adler and Rank, after all, who understood the desperate situation of the child, without falling either into the Freudian trap of inner instincts or that of easy environmentalism. As Rank put it once and for all future psychoanalysts and students of man, every human being is equally unfree. That is, we create out of freedom a prison. Rank was criticizing Rousseau's vision of man as born free and then put into chains by training and by society. Rank understood that in the face of the overwhelmingness of the world, the child could not out of himself muster the stamina and the authority necessary to live in full expansiveness with limitless horizons of perception and experience. We have arrived at a unique stage in the development of psychoanalytic thought. By fully incorporating the work of Adler and Rank on an equal level with Freud, modern psychoanalysis has been able to keep the roundness and soberness of the master without the errors, extreme formulations, and dogma of strict Freudianism. As I see it, Brown's book represents a declaration that the circle has been closed fully between the psychoanalysis of the founders and the most recent theoretical and clinical work, without anything essential being lost. Even on the syndrome that in truth could most justifiably accuse the parents of failing to fashion an adequate human being, that of schizophrenia, there has been a marked change of emphasis, a new consciousness of the tragic dimensions of human life. No one has summed this up better than Harold Searles, and I would like to quote at length his sensitive and authoritative personal statement, which I think is a very important one historically. At Chestnut Lodge, the twice-weekly, hour-long case presentations usually have to do with schizophrenic patients. When the author went there nearly 12 years ago, the therapists, including the author, presenting these cases, often tended to paint a totally or almost totally black picture of the patient's childhood-family relationships. The feeling atmosphere of the presentation was one of blame of the parents more than anything else. As the years have gone on, the author has found that the presentations have come to convey less and less of such blame, and to convey more and more of the tragedy of the patient's lives, tragedy which is so much of a piece with the tragedy of life for all of us that the presentation is often a profoundly grief-laden experience for both the presenter and the listeners. One feels that the staff presentation now gives a truer picture of a patient's life, but a picture which is much more deeply shaking than was the blame-colored picture previously often seen. The tragedy of life that Searles is referring to is the one we have been discussing, man's finitude, his dread of death, and of the overwhelmingness of life. The schizophrenic feels these more than anyone else because he has not been able to build the confident defenses that a person normally uses to deny them. The schizophrenic's misfortune is that he has been burdened with extra anxieties, extra guilt, extra helplessness, an even more unpredictable and unsupportive environment. He is not surely seated in his body, has no secure base from which to negotiate a defiance of and a denial of the real nature of the world. The parents have made him massively inept as an organism. He has to contrive extra ingenious and extra desperate ways of living in the world that will keep him from being torn apart by experience, since he is already almost apart. We see again confirmed the point of view that a person's character is a defense against despair, an attempt to avoid insanity because of the real nature of the world. Searles looks at schizophrenia precisely as the result of the inability to shut out terror, as a desperate style of living with terror. Frankly, I don't know anything more cogent that needs to be said about this syndrome. It is a failure in humanization, which means a failure to confidently deny man's real situation on this planet. Schizophrenia is the limiting test case for the theory of character and reality that we have been expounding here. The failure to build dependable character defenses allows the true nature of reality to appear to man. It is scientifically apodictic. The creativity of people on the schizophrenic end of the human continuum is a creativity that springs from the inability to accept the standardized cultural denials of the real nature of experience. And the price of this kind of almost extra-human creativity is to live on the brink of madness, as men have long known. The schizophrenic is supremely creative in an almost extra-human sense because he is furthest from the animal. He lacks the secure instinctive programming of lower organisms, and he lacks the secure cultural programming of average men. No wonder he appears to average men as crazy. He is not in anything's world. Note: for a fuller summing up of the problem of schizophrenic failure, see Chapter 10. End of note. Conclusion. Let us close our long discussion of the function of character by juxtaposing two great pieces of poetic writing and insight, separated by almost three centuries. The first, by Thomas Traherne, gives a beautiful description of the world as it appears to the perceptions of the child before he has been able to fashion automatic reactions. Traherne describes the pristine perceptions of the child. All appeared new and strange at first, inexpressibly rare and delightful and beautiful. The corn was orient and immortal wheat, which never should be reaped, nor was ever sown. I thought it had stood from everlasting to everlasting. The dust and stones of the street were as precious as gold. The gates were at first the end of the world. The green trees, when I saw them first through one of the gates, transported and ravished me. Their sweetness and unusual beauty made my heart to leap, and almost mad with ecstasy. They were such strange and wonderful things. The men, oh, what venerable and reverend creatures did the aged seem! Immortal cherubims! And young men, glittering and sparkling angels, and maids, strange seraphic pieces of life and beauty. Boys and girls tumbling in the street and playing were moving jewels. I knew not that they were born or should die. The city seemed to stand in Eden. We might call this the paradise of pre-repression. But then Traherne goes on to describe his fall from Eden. The development of cultural perceptions and denials of the pristine character of reality. And like a modern psychoanalyst in the early days of, say, Chestnut Lodge, he accuses the parents of this fall, makes his whole case against them. Thoughts are the most present things to thoughts, and of the most powerful influence. My soul was only apt and disposed to great things, but souls to souls are like apples to apples, one being rotten rots another. When I began to speak and go, nothing began to be present to me but what was present to me in their thoughts. Nor was anything present to me any other way than it was so to them. All things were absent which they talked not of. So I began among my playfellows to prize a drum, a fine coat, a penny, a gilded book, etc. As for the heavens and the sun and stars, they disappeared, and were no more unto me than the bare walls. So that the strange riches of man's invention quite overcame the riches of nature, being learned more laboriously and in the second place. What is missing in this splendid portrayal of the child's fall from natural perception into the artificialities of the cultural world? Nothing less than what we have cited as the great post-Freudian merger on the human personality. Traherne's own complicity in the process, his need to fall from grace in order to grow, move about without anxiety, protect himself against the sun, the stars, the heavens. Traherne doesn't record his other pristine reaction, say, to the piercing screams of his playfellows, as they cut their hands or smashed their noses and mouths, and splashed him with globs of weird, warm red that sent terror into his bowels. He says that he knew not that they should die, that all seemed immortal. But did his parents introduce death into the world? This was the deep-lying rot that rubbed into his soul, and it rubbed in not from the parents, but from the world, from the riches of nature. In some complex ways, death edged itself as a symbol into his perceptions and chilled his soul. And to banish the facts of life, Traherne had to remold his paradise, even to lying about it in his memory as we all do. True, the earth was the place of mystical beauty that he painted it, and that Carlyle later agreed to be a mystic temple. But it was at the same time a hall of doom that Traherne chose to deny in his memory of childhood. The totality of the human condition is the thing that is so hard for man to recapture. He wants his world safe for delight, wants to blame others for his fate. Compare to Traherne a modern poet's consciousness of the full roundness of the human condition. Marcia Lee Anderson tells us with penetrating brilliance how we have to live in a hall of doom, what we need to do to protect ourselves. We multiply diseases for delight, invent a horrid want, a shameful doubt, luxuriate in license, feed on night, make inward bedlam, and will not come out.